Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, let's open the pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal and see what we discover. Here's the biz page, and under the biz page, under the heading of Big Project, comes the article, Raleigh Firm Heads to Wilmington. A pair of real estate companies with offices in Raleigh and Wilmington have kicked off construction on a massive new industrial project on the coast as demand for flex and warehouse space continues to skyrocket across the state. Edgewater Ventures and partner McKinley Building Corporation recently announced the start of construction on the Wilmington Trade Center, a three-building, 425,000-square-foot industrial development in Wilmington. The company has already begun work on the first building, calling for 157,610 square feet of Class A industrial space. That building is set to deliver in September. We're extremely excited to partner with McKinley to develop our first Class A industrial building in Wilmington, says Edgewater's Chris Norvell. We're bullish about the long-term growth of the region and view this development as extremely well-positioned to serve companies looking for a best-in-class facility. Also on this week's biz page, under the heading of Historic Tie, comes the article, So There Is a Block 83 After All. Biz loves history and connections to the past. So we were puzzled when Heritage Properties named its two-tower development on Hillsborough Street Block 83 as a nod to its location. Biz pulled out William Christmas's original design for the city of Raleigh, and the original plot 83 was what is now the corner of Fayetteville and Davy Streets. And the current Block 83 location was outside the original city limits, which ended at West Street. But something changed. Turns out a fire insurance map from 1888 shows the expanded city with new designations for the plots. And sure enough, 83 is the designation for the current block 83. And under the heading of beautification, watch out, trash cans, here come the flowers. One of the more creative touches in recent memory has been the North Carolina Museum of Art's Art in Bloom project, which included whopping bouquets of flowers and trash cans around the triangle. The pandemic has wiped out plenty of arts programming, but the NCMA plans to hold Arts in Bloom over two weekends, June the 3rd through the 6th and June the 10th through the 13th. Tickets go on sale this month for an event that will include 30 floral arrangements. After more than 2 years since our last Art in Bloom in March 2019, we're more than ready to celebrate the return of one of our favorite events, Museum Director Valerie Hillings says. And if you just want to enjoy the trash can arrangements, you can find their locations on the NCMA's social media channels. And under the heading of Economic Snapshot comes the article, Local Television Revenues Rise. An indication of business confidence is local television advertising. When businesses are optimistic, they advertise. And Joel Davis, the vice president and general manager for WRAL and Fox 50, says business is hopping. This year, the first quarter was very good, and the momentum is surging. Most broadcasters are comparing their business level to 2019, and while most aren't quite to that level yet, they're not far off, he says. That's a very good sign with the back half of the year expected to be very active. And under the heading of A Fresh Start comes the article, New Restaurant Opens in Durham. A new restaurant is open in Durham as the food industry gears back up with the end of the pandemic in sight. Farmside Kitchen in Churchill Commons at 5431 Page Road will serve its signature bowls with fresh grains, protein, and vegetables. Farmside Kitchen CEO Meg Schiffman wants to serve customers eager to get out and get healthy. The pandemic afforded us some time to get this thing right and build a brand that we know can meet people's needs, Schiffman says. And finally, on today's biz page, under the heading of More Than Fried, comes the article, Carteret County, Now Food Haven. A corner of the North Carolina coast known for fried seafood and traditional fare is upping its game on the food scene. What we are seeing is more and more restaurants are staying open year-round, says Tom Keyes, the CEO of the Carteret County Chamber of Commerce, who came to the market in 2006. Back when I first got here, they closed in the winter for a few months. The county's base population is around 70,000 people and swells to 250,000 in the summer. Many from the Triangle have grown up going to places such as the Sanitary Fish Market and Restaurant in Moorhead City and the Dock House Restaurant in Beaufort. But the food scene has grown. Beaufort Grocery dates to 1991. Amos Mosquitoes to 2003 at its current site. Keyes ticks off a number of upscale restaurants in the market now, including Floyd's, Aqua, and more. Even the Circle at Atlantic Beach, once a seedy part of the area, is now undergoing a revitalization, and the upscale Bahia Beach House and Surf Bar opened last fall. Hospitality scene is aided by a first-rate culinary arts program at Carteret Community College. Overall, the county has 153 restaurants, and Jim Browder, the executive director of the Crystal Coast Tourism Development Authority, says 80% of them are locally owned. The number has remained pretty constant, with a few closures, but with an equal amount of new restaurant openings, he says. Key says he's not surprised to see the passion for food in the area. A pastime here is actually eating, he says. When I first got here, I put on 17 pounds. Well, now we'll turn the page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we'll get to the banking and finance page. And the major article on that is under the heading Capital. And the article is entitled, Fulcrum Sets Eye on Area. An Atlanta venture capital firm with cash to burn is looking for its next big deal, and the Triangle is among the regions it's targeting. Fulcrum Equity Partners, which recently closed on $275 million in growth capital, its largest fund to date, is on the hunt for deals. And that includes in the Carolinas, said Jim Douglas, a partner at the Atlanta firm. Fulcrum has more than $600 million under management. Fulcrum invests primarily in two areas, healthcare services and IT, and tech. And it's the tech side that has already demonstrated local interest. Triangle firms GoPivot and Kevel, K-E-V-E-L, formerly known as AdZerk, are among its investments. And Douglas expects additional attention in the region. The firm sees 1,000 deals a year, Douglas estimates, and to get his attention, companies need passionate management. The entrepreneur and the team is one of the most important things, Douglas says. Nobody wants to get in a situation where you're struggling with your founder team. He advises that pitching entrepreneurs be able to back up what they're saying with real numbers. What you don't like to see are people who are loose on those kinds of things, Douglas says. The firm starts with as little as $4 million to $5 million, but can funnel up to $25 million into an individual company. When a tech company catches Fulcrum's attention, it's typically between $2 million and $10 million in revenue. Also, a couple of small articles on this page, and under the heading of financing comes the article, Durham Startup Attracts More Celebrity Investors. A Durham startup has attracted more celebrity attention in the form of millions in new financing. Lolly, which deals in Bitcoin rewards, has raised $5 million from multiple investors, including 776, the venture capital fund headed by Reddit founder Alexis Ohanian, husband of tennis star Serena Williams. The company, co-founded in 2018 by serial entrepreneurs Matt Center and Alex Edelman, is on a mission to make Bitcoin an approachable currency for everyone. And in an interview, Center, the technical brains of the operation, says the cash will go toward fueling that mission, as well as building out the headcount, currently at 11 full-time employees. The firm's $3 million seed financing round attracted notables such as actor Ashton Kutcher and YouTube makeup celebrity Michelle Phan. And under the heading of loan demand comes the article Bankers Talk PPP Extension. The Paycheck Protection Program deadline is being extended to May 31st, but not every bank intends to keep accepting loan applications. Last week, the Senate passed legislation to push back what had been a March 31st deadline for applications. But bank leaders say the demand for loans has fallen off tremendously, meaning some banks don't need the extra time. And here we have quotes from three local bankers. First, from Mary Willis, CEO of the Fidelity Bank in Fuquay Varina. And our quote, "My biggest concern is the money and the program lasting until the end of May. So far, we've taken about 70% of the number of applications we did last year with round one." And next, Jim Sills, CEO at M&F Bank. "We will continue to work through loans in the order they have arrived, but are not unreasonably rushing since the extension's been approved." And finally, Travis Bailey, regional executive at First Bank. PPP round two volume continues to be much lighter than round one within the Triangle market. "Our corporate and Triangle teams have shifted our focus toward working through the forgiveness process for our portfolio of clients." Well, now let's turn the page and see what we find on the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of industrial comes the article, "Wigeon Starts on Big Project." That's W-I-G-E-O-N. A Raleigh developer has begun work on a massive industrial project in Garner, with the first of five flex and warehouse buildings underway. This month, Raleigh-based Wigeon Capital announced its plans to bring 410,000 square feet of industrial space across five buildings slated for the Greenfield Business Park in Garner. The park is situated near the intersection of U.S. 70 and Interstate 40 and a fast-growing part of town. Garner's growing. With the confluence of the road system and the proximity to downtown Raleigh, we see the potential for this trend to continue, Wigeon Capital said in a statement. Construction has begun on the first building. Plans call for 58,000 square feet of industrial space at 3300 Waterfield Drive. Raleigh brokerage firm Tri Properties, NAI Carolinic Realty, is representing Wigeon Capital on the project. "Our first building under construction, 3300 Waterfield Drive, is well designed and located to accommodate the high flex demand that the Triangle region is experiencing," said Jimmy Barnes, executive vice president at TRI Properties and NAI Carolina Realty. "That first building will be followed by a 96,000 square foot structure, complete with tilt wall construction and a 32-foot clear height. Wigeon hopes to begin work on that in the second quarter." The company has plans for three more buildings on an adjacent lot. The largest building will be a 150,000 square foot bulk distribution facility that will be followed by two shallow bay industrial buildings on the same parcel, one being 58,000 square feet and the other 48,000 square feet. "This new product is perfect for everything from life sciences and manufacturing to service providers and assembly," said Joe Stallings, Garner's Economic Development Director. In addition to its properties in Garner, Wigeon also has properties in Briar Creek and Raleigh, included in its roughly 500,000 square foot portfolio. And a couple of other small articles on the page under the heading of mixed use. 578 residences and commercial space proposed in Wendell. The town of Wendell is reviewing plans for a newly proposed residential mixed-use development, this one calling for hundreds of new homes plus commercial space on the northern side of town. Last month, Zebulon-based developer Wendell Glennon LLC submitted a rezoning request with Wendell to allow for the development of the Glennon, calling for 570 residences and 30,000 square feet of commercial space. The project is situated on about 55 acres across two parcels at 9021 U.S. 64 Highway East by the interchange with I-87, on the other side from the Wake Tech Community College site. Filings with the town call for 242 homes plus 12 apartment buildings with a total of 336 apartments. And I guess here's an article on persistence entitled Chapel Hill Condo Gets Approval. In 1989, White Oak Properties founder Roland Gammon bought a piece of property in Chapel Hill with plans to develop the site. But he didn't realize it would take three decades to see a project approved. Over the next 32 years, the property would see proposal after proposal run into challenges and fail. Until this week, when the town approved a rezoning request for a new condo project on the property. On March 24th, the Chapel Hill Town Council unanimously approved a rezoning for Gammon and developer David Roberts' proposed South Columbia Annex, allowing for the development of up to 60 condo units, plus up to 4,000 square feet commercial space. And 15% of the units will be reserved for buyers making below the area median income. The site is situated on a little less than 4 acres at 1150 South Columbia Street at Fordham Boulevard, also known as Highway 54, south of downtown. It was Gammon's fourth attempt to rezone the property. With permitting and administration processes now underway, he says he hopes to break ground early next year. Gammon paid $237,500 for the property in 1989. Since then, he's proposed a hotel and several condo projects with no success until this year. And finally, under the heading of Johnston County Surge, the article 282 Homes Planned in Clayton. A South Carolina home builder has plans to bring new homes to Clayton as builders from around the region flood into the growing market. Earlier this year, Irmo, South Carolina-based Mungo Homes of North Carolina Incorporated filed plans for Country Lane, calling for 282 single-family detached home lots across 117.6 acres in Clayton. The project is situated at the intersection of Country Lane and Jasper Drive, south of downtown Clayton. Well, now it's time to turn the page, and we encounter the retail and restaurants page. Under the heading of New Competition comes the article, Online Grocer Enters Area. An online grocer recently began delivering in the Raleigh area after taking over a 30,000-square-foot facility. Farmstead leased the space at 2351 Atlantic Avenue in North Raleigh and started delivering groceries within a 50-mile radius on March 24th. The company seeks out warehouses between 15,000 and 30,000 square feet, which are ideal for both Farmstead and the property owner, CEO and co-founder Pradeep Alankumaran says. We've had strong interest and availability in these spaces, he says. Given that we are an online-focused enterprise that doesn't require a lot of build-out, we can open locations in a very nimble way without spending too much money. Landlords find us to be quite attractive tenants. The typical investment cost to open a Farmstead location, including Raleigh, is well under $100,000, with a minimum annual revenue threshold of about $15 million, Alankumaran says. Charlotte was the first market the company entered outside of San Francisco, where it is based. the Welan Kamaran has long planned the expansion into the Triangle. Our job is to increase the capacity in any market and increase the probability that a customer will sign up by giving them e-commerce experience that they've already gotten used to, but tailored to online grocery shopping, he says. By that, I mean the same, if not lower, prices than the store, free delivery to their doorstep in a short time frame, and high-quality service every time. The company, which announced its entrance into the region's busy grocery market in November, is vertically integrated and does not get its products from a supermarket like traditional grocery delivery services, Alan Kamaran says. The company is counting on its inventory control methods, including artificial intelligence technology, to stand out from its counterparts to avoid product substitutions or shortages. Its dark store transforms large spaces into grocery stores and helps combat food deserts, which could lead to even more expansion, Alan Kamaran says. Each 30,000-square-foot warehouse has at least 100 employees and can make hundreds of deliveries per day. Farmstead does about 4,000 to 5,000 orders per day, with the number of employees expanding to adjust for growth. And on the food front, under the heading of "It Comes with a Twist," comes the article, "Chick-fil-A Picks New Location in Raleigh." A new Chick-fil-A restaurant may soon be coming to Raleigh, but chicken sandwich lovers could have to use the drive-thru to satisfy their cravings. Plans are in place for a drive-thru-only location at 651 East Six Forks Road near Wake Forest Road. The city is reviewing a site permit application from New Jersey-based Bowler Engineering on behalf of the property owner to redevelop the site. While we are excited to be moving closer toward a Chick-fil-A restaurant in Raleigh on East Six Forks Road, we do not have any updates to share on timing, Chick-fil-A said in a prepared statement. We look forward to serving all of our guests with great food and genuine hospitality. And finally on this page, under the heading of 100,000 square feet, the article, "Raleigh Developer Buys Shopping Center." A Raleigh real estate developer took over about 100,000 square feet of vacant space at a strip mall on Maitland Drive near New Bern Avenue in the capital city. But Atlas Stark founding partner Gabe Gilois said it's too soon to announce what specifically is in store for Tower Shopping Center off the Interstate 440 Beltline. Firm subsidiary New Bern Development made the $5.8 million purchase from Louisiana-based business owner M2K, which also includes the Go and Chow Company out of Wake Forest. The transaction includes a retail center and the surrounding parking lots. A few businesses are still in the location, including DD's Discount Stores, K&W Cafeteria, and Papa John's Pizza. We'll make some capital improvements to the property and put a professional leasing and management plan in place, Gilois says. So far, some exterior work has begun on the shopping center, which was built in 1983. New Bern Development also acquired nearby overflow parking on Bastion Lane from the seller for $964,500. Atlas Stark has several commercial properties in the Triangle and announced plans for a mixed-use development up to 20 stories tall at Dorothea Dix Park last fall. Now we'll turn the page and reach the column entitled Executive Voice. And this week's executive voice belongs to Michael Benguitz. The article is entitled "A Commitment to Battling Rare Diseases." After amassing nearly 15 years of combined experience performing executive consulting work, Michael Benguitz joined United Therapeutics a decade ago. He initially served as the company's executive vice president for organizational development, where he was responsible for ensuring the health of its strategy, structure, and systemic aspects of its infrastructure. In 2016, the United Therapeutics founder, chair, and CEO, Martin Rothblatt, asked Benkowitz to step into the roles of president and chief operating officer. Based in its co-headquarters in Research Triangle Park, where nearly half the company's 950 employees work, Benkowitz now oversees the day-to-day operations of the entire company and will be instrumental in developing a new master plan for the RTP campus. United Therapeutics also has locations at its other co-headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland, and elsewhere, stretching from Florida to California and Quebec. So, here are the questions. Give us a brief synopsis of the current United Therapeutics. And his answer, United Therapeutics is dedicated to saving lives. We focus on serving patients with rare and underserved lung and cardiovascular diseases. Our goal is to find a cure for end-stage organ diseases, such as pulmonary arterial hypertension, sometimes known as PAH, and pulmonary fibrosis. What are the essential functions of the United Therapeutics facility and RTP? It's hard to overstate the importance of our RTP operations. This is the home of our commercial sales team and where we do much of our manufacturing, research, and product development work. We have a strong support team here as well, including finance and information technology. We also do essentially all our product labeling and packing in RTP. Specifically, our oral drug, Orenitram, is manufactured here, and we're conducting our regenerative medicine research here, among many other projects. So what does the future hold for the company's RTP facility? His answer, if all goes to plan, we're on the cusp of tremendous growth, and our research and development and manufacturing teams at RTP are a big part of our plans. United Therapeutics has 4 product launches targeted for this year. We already launched one in February, and we continue working on development programs to further expand the label for our inhaled Tyvaso medicine. In addition, we're working to bring a novel drug for PAH, Ralinepag, to the market in the next few years. We also have teams in RTP that are exploring innovative ways to deliver our PAH treatment, treprostinil, through pain-free subcutaneous injections and once-daily oral administration. You'll also see some changes on our RTP campus soon. We're always looking for ways to optimize our real estate portfolio, and we're currently developing a new master plan for the RTP campus. As part of that effort, we plan to consolidate our warehousing capabilities and expand our office footprint. We're also exploring how we can best prepare our RTP footprint to support our organ manufacturing program, which is focused on developing an unlimited supply of transplantable hearts, kidneys, and lungs. We're also committed to sustainability with our expansion. We recently built a site net zero daycare center on campus, and we're considering other cutting-edge technologies to deploy on campus to reduce our carbon footprint as we continue to grow. So what are the latest developments in the drugs the company is manufacturing in RTP? We manufacture our oral treprostinil drug that's called Orenitram in RTP. We also label and package 4 products here, Orenitram, Remodulin, that's our injectable version of treprostinil, Tyvaso, that's our inhaled version of treprostinil, and Unituxin, a unique biologic drug for neuroblastoma, a rare pediatric cancer. There have been exciting developments with Orenitram. We recently expanded the label following a successful clinical trial, and as a consequence, have seen an increased uptake of Orenitram in the PAH community and corresponding double-digit percent increase in sales. At the same time, we're excited about the potential that our organ manufacturing programs could provide to patients with end-stage organ diseases. The programs are cutting edge, and there's a bunch of risk to getting to market, but we think it's worth it to address such an unmet need. Our programs include studies into xenotransplantation, which is the use of porcine kidneys and hearts for human transplantation, regenerative medicine, where we use these cellularized scaffolds of porcine lungs to house human cells to create transplantable lungs. Research that's done right here in RTP, and the use of 3D printing to create lungs from the patient's own cells. So how does the recent news about United Therapeutics dropping Travient after receiving written comments from the U.S. FDA affect the company and RTP? A core tenet of our R&D strategy has always been a commitment to engage in several parallel research programs to address a complex illness or therapeutic treatment. This multiple shots on goal approach is fundamental to our culture of innovation. Not all shots score, so multiple shots are desirable. We elected to discontinue development of the Travent subcutaneous treprostinil pump after recent comments from the FDA indicated that it would take a multi-year effort to secure approval, and even then, there were no guarantees. Meanwhile, we completed development and recently launched another subcutaneous pump called the Remunity Pump for Remodulin. In this case, we were fortunate to have two shots on goal, given the difficulties presented by the FDA in obtaining Travient approval. Our decision to move forward without Travient has no impact on our operations or workforce in RTP or elsewhere. So, what are your goals for the company? In the short term, we're focused on our target to launch four new products in 2021, all of which underscore our commitment to a balanced, value-creating biotechnology model. In February, we launched the Remunity Pump for Remodulin. It represents a revolutionary change in the way patients administer subcutaneous Remodulin therapy. Assuming FDA approval in early April, the second launch will be a new indication for Tavasso in pulmonary hypertension associated with interstitial lung disease. This is a rare condition for which there are currently no approved therapies that affects more than 30,000 patients in the United States. If, along with our partner, Medtronic, we're able to complete some post-approval marketing requirements, the third product is the implantable system for Remodulin that represents a fully implantable way to deliver Remodulin to patients. The final project is Tyvaso DPI, a novel dry powder formulation of Tyvaso that could reach market, assuming we receive a timely FDA approval for the Tyvaso indication expansion in April and DPI FDA approval in December. Our long-term vision revolves around pursuing revolutionary ways to treat end-stage organ diseases with an unlimited supply of organs that can be transplanted into humans. As I mentioned, some of that exciting research is being conducted right here in RTP. What's your greatest professional accomplishment? I'm living it. United Therapeutics is at an inflection point right now, poised to significantly expand the number of patients we can help with our therapies over the next decade. We're conducting really innovative R&D, and our employees, whom we call Unitherians, are the brightest and most passionate collection of individuals I've worked with in my career. I'm proud of the small role I've played in helping build UT to this point, and I'm really excited about what we're going to do together in the future. What do you do to relax? Well, I grew up playing tennis and still love the sport, so I try to get out and play two or three times a week. My younger daughter, Melissa, plays competitive volleyball, and Michelle and I really enjoy watching her tournaments on the weekends and spending time with her teammates' parents. When we're not doing that, we're usually spending time at our lake house in the North Carolina mountains. Finally, what book is currently on your nightstand? His answer, Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art by James Nestor. Now we get to this week's cover story. It's entitled North Carolina State of Healthcare. This is an extremely long article, and there's no chance that I'll have an opportunity to read all of it. This is a collaboration between the three business journals in the state. That's the Charlotte, Triad, and Triangle Business Journal. And this represents a panel of a number of health professionals in this area. Specifically, there's Terry Aiken, the CEO of Cone Health, Dr. Wesley Burks, the CEO of UNC Healthcare, Gene Woods, who's the CEO of Atrium Health, and this panel was moderated by Caroline Hudson, who's a healthcare reporter for the Charlotte Business Journal. And this article is entitled "One Year Later." So, facing a once-in-a-generation pandemic, the state's largest health systems have taken serious financial hits, learned some valuable lessons, and discovered some silver linings that will last long after COVID-19 is behind them. The pandemic accelerated the use of virtual and home-based care, and PPE shortages drove a dramatic shift in predictive analytics for managing supply chains. Health systems heavily leveraged partnerships with community groups to get care and vaccines to underserved and rural populations. And the consolidation that has and will continue to take place provided scale that's allowed health systems to participate in trials, organize vaccinations, and weather the financial strains the pandemic created. CEOs from three of North Carolina's top healthcare systems addressed those points and many others in a joint virtual roundtable organized by Charlotte Business Journal, Triad Business Journal, and Triangle Business Journal. The conversation, which aired March 18th, featured Terry Aiken of Cone Health, Dr. Wesley Burks of UNC Health, Gene Woods of Atrium Health, and was moderated by Business Journal reporter Caroline Hudson. What will the industry look like in the next 5 years? Woods expects health systems to increasingly build up partnerships and community engagement. There's really no societal challenge or issues with racial equality that can be solved by any one institution, Woods says. We really need to collaborate, and I think that's going to be a way that we can do business going forward. Where care is delivered will also continue to evolve, with Aiken predicting that our hospitals are going to look much more like places that care for the sickest and the most critically ill, because we're going to be able to do so much in the community and in homes over the next decade. As Burks echoed that expectation, he pointed to another ongoing imperative, health equity. We've known it for a long time, but it's not been a point of we have to do something different. And I feel like each of us here in the state and nationally, we have to pay attention to it, and we have to be able to address not only the health care, but the other social drivers of health in a way that we hadn't before. We can't not do that going forward. Following is a condensed version of the hour-long roundtable edited for brevity and clarity. And as I said, this article is so long, there's no way I'm going to be able to read all of it, so I'll read as much as I can. Hudson, bring us back to a year ago when COVID-19 was starting to spread in North Carolina. Is there anything that you know now that you wish you had known then? And Wesley Burks offers this. There are so many memories and so many lessons. Think about last February, really into March. I don't think any of us had any idea of the different ways and longevity of what would happen in this next year. I think that's probably good. We're able to think about how we need to get the people in the right places, get the processes in place so we can meet the coming pandemic. But there are a lot of really good memories and lessons that I know will last each of us a lifetime. Terry Aiken. I was joking with my colleagues before we came on. We kind of referred to it as the COVID time warp. It's a little hard to believe that it's been a year, but in a way it also seems like a lifetime. We all pride ourselves on having learning organizations, but I think we were learning organizations on steroids. We were trying to contain and manage a whole lot of unknowns. There were moments it felt very chaotic. We've learned so much about how to manage our COVID patients, our population. Back in March, April, May, we were scrambling to find enough PPE, masks and gowns and drapes, and we still have major challenges. But when I compare it to where we were, we've got a much more manageable, even-keel situation. Gene Woods. We were making decisions in a matter of hours and days that might have normally taken weeks and months. There were conversations about establishing a field hospital, and we realized because of the hot spots around the country, we weren't going to get additional staffing or PPE, which were all in short supply. I remember sitting down with a team and they said, well, how about a hospital at home concept that we can treat people at home? We have telehealth capabilities. We have a very strong monitoring capability. If somebody needs something, we have medics that could deliver medications to do interventions. And really, in a matter of a week or so, we had already sketched out the hospital at home concept. We've seen about 50,000 patients in their home. Now, it's actually going to be baked into how we deliver care well beyond the pandemic. So that old saying that necessity is a mother of invention, we saw that in so many ways. That's only going to make us a better health system and the field going forward. Aiken. Nationally, we saw people accessing virtual care and telehealth visits, something like at a rate 10 times higher than they ever had before. There will be some silver linings out of all this. Do you think a year into this, we have a better understanding of COVID as a virus? Aiken. Without a doubt, there are some very unique idiosyncratic aspects around managing, particularly respiratory elements of this disease, which were not apparent to our caregivers out of the gate, and which really had to be learned. It really was a great example of communication within and across our healthcare systems. Berks, the science that has come out of the pandemic in the last year is pretty remarkable. Understanding of the immunology and why it has spike proteins and what it does to the respiratory tract, the treatments that have been developed and tried pretty quickly. And the most amazing thing is the development of multiple types of vaccines, new vaccines that had never been used before. And we have them available in less than a year. Even though it's slower than we would all like, we've vaccinated a significant population of the country already, and we're at a year into it. The science of even the vaccination process that will be applicable to cancer, autoimmune disease will continue for the rest of our lifetime and beyond. Woods, we're still learning. We're going to continue to still learn. But we're in a much better situation now. And also, obviously, have the excitement of vaccines. That's a game changer for us all. So how are you navigating the lack of vaccine supplies or anything that the state and federal governments can do to ease that strain? Aiken, I'm comfortable that we can help people get vaccinated wherever, and then it will provide them relief from being concerned about the coronavirus. So that's the big picture. That's exciting. Like everything else in life, when you look behind the scenes, there are lots of things we wish we could have gone better, done better. Then there was more production from the companies, that there was better coordination between the federal government and the state, between the state and the entities as they gave out vaccines. But we set up 17 vaccination sites all across the state, both in the Triangle and the bigger urban areas and out in the rural area. I feel like the state started a little slowly compared to others. We didn't get into the communities most in need of the vaccine as quickly as we should have. But I do feel like the healthcare system represented here or in the state, we've caught up for the most part. If you look at the rural communities, the underrepresented communities, we're getting the vaccines to people that need it most right now. Woods. We, at Atrium, have put about 300,000 shots in arms today, so things are ramping up. Initially, it's been a supply issue, but also the classic last mile issue. How do you get shots in arms in a state that has a combination of rural and urban areas? One of my neighbors is the CEO of Honeywell, so we took a walk on a Sunday, and I shared some of the logistical challenges and obviously IT just registering in the systems. Partnering with Honeywell and the Carolina Panthers and Charlotte Motor Speedway, we were able to put together some of the country's largest mass vaccination events. What's going to be helpful for us going forward is these partnerships between health systems, public health, government, and businesses to really deal with some of these challenges. We've been able to put 1,500 shots in arms every hour. The wait time has been about 25 to 30 minutes. You see around the country people in waiting in lines 3 or 4 hours. We've shared sort of a playbook with President Biden's coronavirus task force to see if it's helpful to anybody else in the country. The challenge and the opportunity is really this distribution that worked throughout the country. We need to get shots in arms faster. that these new variants take hold. That's really the thing that keeps us all up at night right now. Aiken, I'm really proud of us across the state of North Carolina. We've got the capacity, both through fixed vaccination sites, mobile efforts, partnerships with churches, schools, and communities, particularly to reach the underserved. We probably have the shot-giving capacity to do 3 or 4 times as much as we're doing now. And the rate limiter there really is supply. I'm hopeful we're going to see an increase in supply. Another area that we've all focused on is reaching underserved communities, reaching minority communities often, which, if just sort of left to more traditional means, would be disproportionately disadvantaged in terms of the and their access to vaccines. At Cone Health, for example, we've actually said that 35% of all of our vaccine allocations will go into black and brown arms. And I think that's a really important stake to put in the ground. And I know many others around the state have made similar commitments. Woods. We had strong relationships in the community before. They've really strengthened during this program. And during this period, there's a coalition of churches here in the Charlotte area called Village Heartbeat. It's about 60 congregations, black and brown churches included, and we've really worked hand in hand with them. What we realized is we really need to double down in terms of how we reach communities. We have roving vans, and we would go to these church parking lots, the YMCA parking lots. Our latest data is when we use a roving van, 75% of the vaccines administered are to black and brown people. That's really an essential tool to reach these communities, especially sometimes when there are transportation and other related issues. We finally rethought how we approach communities, all of them, all of us have. Aiken, if anything, this pandemic has given new meaning to the term partnership. I think we realized early on that it is so dependent upon partnerships in the community. So that we're not just in the community, we're in the community. So churches, community groups where people are comfortable. Question. 2020 was certainly a tough fiscal year for everyone. Reports were saying that healthcare systems spent at least $1 billion just on COVID costs, and I'm sure that continues to increase. So what's your state of your health system's financials? Woods. We took a several $100 million hit during this process. I think the recovery continues. We voluntarily shut down elective surgeries, and we realized that what was at one point elective was urgent and then emergent. As we decided we weren't going to lay off any staff, there was a lot of anxiety, and we wanted to show our team that we were there for them. Those were significant hits financially. We realized once we opened back up and began to do elective and urgent procedures again, the community wanted to make sure we were doing safe care. So we launched the COVID Safe initiative, communicating when you come in, we're going to mask. This is what we're doing with cleaning surfaces, with temperature checks. We also would give surveys. 98% felt safe, which is really good to hear. The 2% had really good suggestions that we used in the rapid cycle improvement. We're seeing more people returning for what's really essential care. We really are continuing to make significant investments in our community. We're playing the long game here. You know, the investments we're making in the Wake Forest School of Medicine campus here, an innovation quarter, and really improving some of our physical structures. We're going to continue to do that. We'll continue to create more jobs. Aiken. In March, April, and May, when we were in a blanket way canceling all elective procedures, that was creating some major financial challenges, as were the costs associated with ramping up to care for COVID patients. We mobilized a field hospital. It was sort of fortuitous. Literally a month and a half prior, we had vacated a 100-bed women's hospital, which became our COVID facility. And you don't set those things up for free. What changed was we really began to understand how to operate in parallel worlds. While we were all getting our bearings to manage a very chaotic, uncertain situation, we swung the pendulum all the way over to canceling elective cases. We modulated that over time and began to understand how we could safely care for other patients. And I think we've largely overcome a lot of that. It's also allowed us to bring back into balance our ongoing financial performance. You ask how we're doing financially? We were challenged, but we're strong. It was a learning process, and it was all about, over time, modulating and moderating the balance so that we can continue to do what we've always done, and that is care for people across our communities and remain financially viable in the process. Berks, for each of us, we came into this with a fairly strong financial standing and then faced the double hit at the beginning, the cancellation of procedures, and then the investment that all of us had to do in PPE. In the year, we've ordered 110 million pairs of gloves, 12 million ear loop masks, and 8 million N95s. Those are all extraordinary numbers that in a normal year we would not even come close to approaching. In the recovery period, each of us are able to get more real-time data on a daily basis that help us expand or contract what we're doing, and that will last long into the future. But what's happened? The site of care has changed. For many of us, the emergency department volumes are down 15 to 20%. Overall, it looks maybe 5% less than it did outside of COVID a year ago. But outside of the March, April, May timeframe, it's been back to what you would have expected financially through the year. Finally, what are you doing to contribute to the goal of making healthcare more affordable? Berks reply, our colleagues here at the university campus often work 1 week a month to pay for their healthcare. And that's not right. It doesn't feel good. And each of us, we all want to help provide healthcare at a lower cost, as close to home as possible. And we can do that, both in the care in place that each of us are doing, the care redesign, and also trying to lessen the cost by changing health disparities. The other part is the transparency of what costs are. We've developed a price estimator tool for here in Chapel Hill and at Rex that we're rolling out across the system so that if I'm a patient and I want to look at what it might cost me, I have the ability to go look before I come get that care. Again, I know each of us is doing something in that space, but the care redesign to try to provide better health care closer to home, if possible, at a lower cost is a goal. Aiken, if you look at our health care system at large across the U.S., many would say there are a number of ways it's fundamentally broken and needs significant reinvention. Historically, it's been based on a volume and production-based paradigm. The more I do to you, the sicker you are, the more I get paid. We're always going to need to take exemplary care of people who are sick or injured, but more and more our focuses are on partnering with people to stay well and healthy, manage their lifestyle, manage chronic diseases. It's the right thing. It's what they want. It's what we should provide. It's a tough challenge because not all of our payment and reimbursement models really incentivize and reward that kind of behavior. So there's a lot of work left to do. As I said, the cover story was extremely expensive, and I haven't been able to read all of it, but I've read most of it. Now, finally, we come to the editor's notebook of this week's TBJ, and the article is entitled Why Neighborhood Shops Will Thrive in the Future. Reading the story on how JPMorgan Chase, Salesforce.com, PricewaterhouseCoopers are all looking to unload their real estate leases at locations all over the U.S. made me wonder about the next opportunity in commercial real estate. It's going to be in neighborhood shopping villages. In the past week, based on reporting by the Wall Street Journal, we found out that at the end of 2020, 137 million square feet of office space was available in the U.S. That thanks to data crunched by real estate giant CBRE. That number was up by 40% from 2019 and was the highest in 2003. So what's going on? Companies are beginning to dump their leases, primarily in the urban core of cities that include downtown, midtown, and large commercial business districts. That does not mean you will have large office space go vacant for years. For now, the subleases will be picked up by smaller companies at a heavily discounted rate, but the lease terms likely will be shorter. All of this is happening due to one primary reason: remote work. While most companies will ask their employees to come back to work at some point, it's clear that having workers sit side by side in a 200-square-foot cubicle for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, may not work anymore. Companies would offer options, among which will include work from home, staggered office schedules, and reconfigured office spaces. In the end, remote work is most likely here to stay. And that creates a new opportunity for the reemergence of neighborhood shopping villages. In the past decade, we were convinced that the rise of e-commerce was killing street-level retail, as consumers felt confident of buying everything on the internet. This trend became wildly successful because online retail giants such as Amazon and big retailers such as Walmart made it easy for people to return goods if not satisfied. However, if more people work from home, they don't want to spend even more time at home buying stuff, doing deals, and on Zoom calls with friends and family. They yearn to go out. Neighborhood shops, bars, restaurants, and clothiers may soon see a whole new segment of the remote work population walking up to their stores. These workers, who drove downtown into other business districts for work on a daily basis, are unlikely to head to downtown most of the time for drinks, dinner, and shopping. They would rather stay close to their homes, but they also want to get out of the house to meet with friends and family. If giant commercial real estate developers are looking for the next big thing in real estate in the Triangle, follow the rooftops, I say. Home builders in the Triangle are busy these days, and the land across from those communities should be up for grabs, if not already. Downtowns and clustered business districts are not going away, however. They offer something that neighborhoods can never offer, an option to walk everywhere. That's why real estate in cities such as New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles may have taken a hit during COVID. But numbers prove young people are coming back. Businesses may not be, but people are. For mid-sized cities such as Raleigh, Nashville, Tennessee, and Austin, Texas, what will be worth noting in the next year or two are the trend lines, one that details residential vacancy rate and the other that shows the percentage of sublease space. We'll see then if my theory is correct. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.